T-minus 95. Landing site, Solar City Sanctuary. The voice of the Small's apparent leader was somewhat lispy, but was projected at an impressive volume and enunciated in a very clear manner. This suggested to Dan that his tongue, like his mouth as a whole, bore more in common with a human's than a messenger's, and was thus more capable of creating complex and nuanced vocalizations. It would have been harsh to describe the accent as robotic, and Dan didn't for a minute think accent was a particularly appropriate word, but there was a somehow detached ring to it. Needless to say, however, Dan wondered far less about why the leader sounded exactly as he did than about how it was possible for him to be conversing aloud in English at all. The language was young and far from universal, even on Earth, so Dan's current best guess would have been that the Smalls had been observing Earth for a considerable time, perhaps via television or radio signals, and that their neurological sophistication was such that they were able to speak clearly in a language at their first attempt at replicating it. Their shortness and the roundness of their heads made them look dumpy in some regards, but one thing life had taught Dan McCarthy was to never judge a book by its cover. Excitement grew in Dan's mind as he considered the possibility that the Smalls had picked up language through transmitted signals, since this put a very definite limit on how far from Earth they could be. After all, humanity had only been sending out signals for so long, and those signals only traveled at a certain speed. He didn't put too much weight in these thoughts, well aware that he could be missing some obvious flaw in the overwhelming excitement and drama of his current situation, but in the best-case scenario, it meant that humans could feasibly one day reach Sanctuary again, even if something happened to the two gateways that linked Earth and this newly discovered planet via the volatile intermediary of New Kerguelen. Dan considered all of this as the Small's short legs carried them forward more slowly than he would have liked, and as he followed behind while maintaining a consistent distance, he began to take closer notice of their clothing and footwear. What would have perhaps been most remarkable if he was encountering them before having become so familiar with the messengers was that the Smalls wore any clothing at all. It struck Dan as odd that so far, every species humanity had encountered with the ability to cover parts of their bodies with some kind of fabric had done so. The messengers had, for thousands of years, worn plain tunics colored in accordance with an individual's caste membership, with recently rediscovered statues showing that prior to their contact with the deceptive architects, they had been far more expressive with the outfits. Humans, of course, had developed complex systems of social dress with no relation to comfort or necessity, while no non-human animals on Earth had developed any such system at all. Whether intelligence would always bring with it the urge to modestly cover sexually dimorphic areas, as well as the desire to display either expressive individuality or participatory alignment with a larger group, Dan could only guess. All he knew was that so far, it was 3 for 3 for clothes. The Small's specific form of clothing, in line with an emerging pattern that Dan couldn't miss, had more in common with humanity's than the messengers. Rather than a single tunic as worn by the denizens of New Kerguelen, both pre and post contact with the architects, the Small's wore distinct garments on the upper and lower halves of their short bodies. All were various shades of white and beige, with the absence of any clear delineation giving Dan the impression that the whiter examples were perhaps simply newer and cleaner than the others. The fabric of their shirts, if the term shirts was merited, was loose-fitting and closed coarsely at the neck by a string-tied mechanism more suited to a potato sack than a garment. This was no ghillie-style form of lacing at the collar. There was no collar, and the garment as a whole really couldn't have been any more rudimentary than it was. The sleeves stopped several inches above the wrist of each Small, indicating both that the garments varied in size and that the sleeves were intended to end at a point which would have seen them considered too short from a human or at least Western perspective. Similar could be said for the trousers, which ended several inches above the foot and were crudely tied at the waist by a piece of rope-like string which lay on the outside of the fabric and wasn't interwoven. The upper garment did extend past the waistline, albeit only barely, and Dan was only able to see the waist tie of one small near the side of the group who had inadvertently tucked part of it into his trousers. This added a comical twinge to the first few moments of Dan's walk, reminding him of instances at school when someone would do something like this or commit the even greater error of showing up with one of their trouser legs tucked into a sock. None of the smalls had to worry about this fashion faux pas, given that none wore anything like shoes or even socks, instead walking barefoot in a manner that revealed four nailed toes with one larger than the others. As with their hands, the smalls' feet were eerily similar to humans, but for the absence of one digit. The clothes would have fit a human child just as well as they fit the smalls, though Dan couldn't help but liken them to something from his own mental images of a London orphanage in the Victorian era. He tried not to dwell on the apparent incongruence of a race capable of creating the structures and monuments present on Sanctuary, not having developed a more elegant manner of keeping a garment closed at the neck or waist, be it via a necktie, buttons, zippers, a belt, or even elastication. Dan recognized that it was more than a little anthropocentric to judge something like this, since the garments clearly succeeded in their core tasks of either protecting the wearer's modesty or perhaps guarding their skin from a bright orange sun, and all he could do was wonder whether the hard-to-resist urge to make snap judgments was as universal to intelligent races as the desire for clothing seemed to be. Before too much longer, and with no further communication from Leisha or any of the others, the smalls' leader stopped at the base of a tower, which, from the ground, truly looked as though it stretched upwards forever.
"I will guide you to our principal," the tiny alien announced. "From high he guards."
Still, none of the others communicated with Dan. He figured that Billy and Tara were probably concerned, as he had been, that any conscious telepathic communication between them might be picked up by the smalls. He now knew that the leader hadn't heard his question, or at least strongly inferred it given that no answer came at that point, but did immediately when he vocalized it. But he opted not to tell them this yet, just in case it wasn't true, and just in case Billy being Billy, sent something ill-advised and inappropriate into Dan's mind. The patches they were all wearing were of a kind that enabled them to control who their thoughts were sent to, for instance, allowing Dan to communicate with Leisha but not Tara and Billy. But he knew very well that those imbued with an innate power of telepathy, like Leisha, weren't bound by that restriction. Were Dan to telepathically communicate with Tara but not Billy, for example, Leisha could eavesdrop effortlessly. The more Dan thought about this, the less sense he realized his approach made, for if the smalls could hear his thoughts, they already knew he was trying to keep things from them and would already be able to hear anything Billy was thinking. And if they couldn't, there was nothing to worry about. Still, in a situation such as this, not that he had ever been in a situation quite like this, of course, Dan knew that any kind of needless risk should be avoided. Then, however, and somewhat more troublingly, just before entering the tower, Dan came to consider that there was also a chance that these smalls, or their principal, would have stronger telepathic powers than even Leisha, and would thus be able to overcome his ability to mask his own outgoing thoughts, and in doing so, learn of his cloaked presence. Reading these thoughts from the forefront of Dan's mind, Leisha sent a focused reply.
"I can't change course now," he said, without making a sound. "And Dan, if there are friends, there are friends. I can explain that I was worried, and they'll accept that. If they're not our friends, well, everything is moot."
"They have to be our friends," Dan replied, just as silently, saying this partly to psych himself up.
"Of course," Leisha said in support, though the words entered Dan's mind in a far from convincing mental tone.
Dan cleared his throat. "Okay, guys,"
He spoke aloud to Tara and Billy, keen to project confidence for their benefit. Let's go and meet this principal.
From high he guards,
the 20-strong throng of smalls recited as their leader beckoned Dan forward. From high he guards, Dan echoed, seeing little harm in ingratiating himself with the locals. Whoever the hell he is.